MARIA.net.
Maria with an E, the mouth that roars, the Maria Heller Show. Number one show on the net for 5 years in a row. Though the mainstream press may be frightened, scared, and cowed, she's not afraid to tell the truth and to tell it loud. So watch out, all you Enrons, Halliburtons, Worldcoms, and Worldcons. She's gonna shine, shine, shine the light of truth on you. She's the weapon of mass instruction.
MERIA.net.
Good morning, world. Maria Heller here, alive and kicking in Phoenix, Arizona. A lot of people talk about democracy, the death of democracy. When did we lose our democracy? Well, today you'll find out, and you'll find out that the death blow for democracy happened in 1913. So you're not going to want to miss today's show. And I thought appropriately I would air a piece by Stephen Smith. It's off his CD called The Bell. The title of the piece you're going to be hearing is Merchants of Lies. So stay with me. I have a great show.
While you bomb from the skies, your words, they mean nothing. Your money means less. Your pretense of goodwill's misguided abyss. Your children have left you, and one thing I know is your days are soon to be over.
Stephen Smith, again off his CD, The Bell, and it's called Merchants of Lies. I have had my guest on the line. I don't know if he's still there. Eustace, are you there?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, hold on, please. I thought I lost you.
All right. No, I'll drive here.
Okay. Well, let me introduce my guest, because if you've done your homework and you've been following the show, he truly doesn't need an introduction. His name is Eustace Mullins. In 1952, he wrote what I will tell you is the absolute best book on the Federal Reserve. The name of it is The Secrets of the Federal Reserve. His book's been burned, his book's been banned, and Eustace tells me that everything he learned about the Federal Reserve, he learned in a mental institution. So without further ado, let me put Eustace on so he can explain that. Good morning, Eustace.
Good morning.
How are you this morning?
Oh, I'm calling you, I'm talking to you from the birthplace of Woodrow Wilson, who gave us the Federal Reserve Act.
Ah, Woodrow Wilson. You know, reading your book made me realize that. Did we ever have a president that really cared about America?
Well, Woodrow Wilson, I used to say, in all of my public lectures, I always said, a man who does so much for his country, gave World War I, World War II, the federal income tax, and Federal Reserve System, I said he couldn't be all bad.
Federal income tax. Well, you know, one of the lines I remember reading in your book that I've been using a lot, Eustace, is that the IRS is the collection agency for the Federal Reserve Bank.
Oh, yes, it is. Not only that, but the Federal Reserve Act of 1913 removed the Treasury, the Department of the Treasury, as fiscal agent of the United States government and substituted for it the Federal Reserve System.
Right. But, you know, a lot of Americans don't know that. You know, even when I was about 17 living in New York City,
13.
I had applied for a job at the Federal Reserve Bank thinking it was a regular bank.
Oh.
And I think that a lot, well, luckily I didn't get the job. Their interview and their physical was very grueling. Let's leave it at that. They didn't leave anything unturned.
Well, they pay very well, apparently.
Well, yeah, but it seemed like a very strange place. I probably realized it at the time, but of course I couldn't make the connection because I was only 17.
Oh, heavens.
Right.
I knew when I was young.
Now, Eustace, you say that you learned everything about the Federal Reserve in a mental institution. Do you want to talk a little bit about that and a little bit about Ezra Pound? Who was he? What happened to him?
Well, Ezra Pound was one of the American patriots like Charles Lindbergh and many others who opposed their entry into the Second World War. He said, our entry into the First World War was disastrous for Europe, and if we entered a Second World War there in Europe, we'd cause much more chaos and bloodshed in Europe, which of course was true. And so they indicted him for treason for broadcasting on Radio Rome in Italy, but they never dared to try him because they had no evidence. And instead, they declared him the incompetent and placed him in a St. Elizabeth's Hospital for the Insane in Washington, D.C., which is for drug addicts and political prisoners. So he was scheduled to spend the rest of his life there, but I met an old newspaper man who knew a congressman, and I took him to see Ezra, and he got the congressman to get him out.
Right. Now, how many years did he serve for the supposed treason in a mental institution?
13 and a half years without trial. He was never tried or sentenced or convicted of anything to this day.
Right. So since they did that to him, you know, today what that same thing is happening to several Americans, you know, being locked up without trial, et cetera. So this is nothing new.
Nothing new, no, but he's just the most notorious case because they haven't locked up too many poets.
Right, a poet of all things, right. Well, but who knows where this administration has, you know, can go.
Well, they intend to go all the way. Well, the Guantanamo Bay is probably one of the greatest atrocities against civil liberties in the history of the world.
Right, right. Now, I know that you lecture a lot on the Federal Reserve. How would you put it in the most simple terms? How can you explain? Because it's so intense. Your book took me, I have to tell you, a whole month to read because I didn't want to miss a word.
Oh, it's very concentrated. Well, I spent 3 years going through 5,000 source books at the Library of Congress for the book itself.
Right. So how did you get into the Library of Congress? Because I don't think that's something we can do today, is it?
Oh, yes, you can. The stacks are now closed, but you can get into the Library of Congress, and you can order a book, and they'll bring it to you, maybe.
Maybe.
Usually they bring you an NOS notice. It's a little slip of paper that says not on shelf.
Right. So at any point when you were doing your research, were you surprised at what you were finding?
Oh, I was stunned, and so was Ezra.
Right. Right. And were you afraid that they would try to lock you up, too? I mean, what happened when you issued your book?
Oh, when I finished the book, I took it to New York to be published. I thought everybody would want this book because there was no book about the Federal Reserve System. Well, the publishers told me in New York that they wouldn't dare publish it because their notes would be called in and they would be out of business by Monday.
Wow, and that was in 1952.
Yeah.
Now, wasn't there an instance where your books were burned? Was that here in the United States or was that in Germany?
Yeah, that was a German edition of the Federal Reserve book that was published in 1955 in Germany, an edition of 10,000 copies. And the governor of Germany at that time was James Conant, the president of Harvard University, who invented the anthrax bomb. He was a chemist.
Uh-huh.
And so as governor of Germany, Conant confiscated and burned 10,000 copies of my book. And I was never able to collect one cent because when I contacted the Department of State, they would tell me that Germany was entirely a free, independent country and they had no jurisdiction there. Well, mm-hmm. Germans told me that they were not free. They were still an occupied country, which they are today, as a matter of fact.
Right.
So neither one of them paid me one cent.
Right. Well, crazy. You know, one of the things that I was pretty surprised about, and, you know, I thought I knew history pretty well, is at the time the Federal Reserve was being put together, I had not realized that there was so much of a German population in America.
Oh, yes. They have 52% of German American population was German origin.
Right, and that they had even considered making German a second language here. That was very surprising to me.
Yes, they did. That was early in the first days of the Republic. Because you see, we had so many Germans because the Germans were the Hessian soldiers who settled over here. Obviously, they didn't want to go back to Germany because it was a very poor country.
Right.
And so they all stayed here, and they all became very good citizens.
Right. But some of the Germans weren't too nice, especially the ones that seemed to have ended up on the board of the Federal Reserve.
Oh, yes.
So, you know, you mentioned names that a lot of other writers mention, but they aren't as clear. Let's put it that way. They surely aren't as clear nor as convincing as the way you write your book, because you have dates, times, names, and everything else in here.
Trained by Ezra Pound, you know, four of his proteges won the Nobel Prize for Literature. People like Ernest Hemingway and T.S. Eliot, and the most famous writers of the 20th century. So I'm his last living protege. I haven't won anything yet.
Well, I thought it was very nice of you to dedicate the book to him, since he became so obscure because of his 13 years. Right.
Never heard of the Federal Reserve System when he mentioned it to me, and so it turned out to be quite a revelation.
Well, if you look at it, I mean, you've been around a long time, Eustace. So here it is, 2005, and most people in America still don't know about the Federal Reserve.
But I'm still here, and the Federal Reserve is still here.
Right. So let's get over to, you know, a famous German that seemed to have been the big shot with the Federal Reserve, Paul Warburg.
Yes, Paul Warburg was a partner of Kuhnlow Company, a banking house in New York, and this was a silent representative of the Rothschild family in the United States. They didn't proclaim any affinity with the Rothschild Bank, but they were strictly an agency of the Rothschild Bank.
Right, and he was the one that fashioned Daddy Warbucks in the comic strip to make himself look like
indeed, that was modeled after him and became one of the cartoonists. Most successful characters.
Exactly. I always hated it, though. I never liked the artwork on it. Eustace, let me just read a little something out of your book describing the picture on the front of your book. It says about the cover. The cover reproduces the outline of the eagle from the Red Shield, the coat of arms of the city of Frankfurt, Germany, adopted by Meyer Amschel Bauer, who changed his name from Bauer to Rothschild, meaning Red Shield. Rothschild added 5 golden arrows held in the eagle's talons, signifying his 5 sons, who operated the 5 banking houses of the International House of Rothschild, Frankfurt, London, Paris, Vienna, and Naples. You know, Rothschilds very rarely get mentioned in the news today, Eustace.
Or never. You can read the New York Times for months, you never see that name mentioned.
Right. I mean, on a rare, very rare occasion, I will see something about the Rothschilds. But it's usually, you know, makes them look like they're the salt of the earth.
Oh, indeed. They're great antique collectors and they're great benefactors, supposedly.
Right.
I don't know what they benefit, but
they benefit themselves. They benefit themselves. What else?
Well, it's like John D. Rockefeller, who was one of their proteges. John D. Rockefeller invented modern philanthropy, and for him, any philanthropic activity had to be the most revenue-producing part of his entire corporation.
Right.
Rockefeller philanthropies are that way.
Well, one of the other things that amazed me was I saw a lot of the same old names through this book that are in a lot of other books, from the Kennedy assassination to you name it.
Oh, yes, they're always in there.
Right. So do you think that these are all the same people that have been behind all the dastardly things that go on in our country and obviously the world?
Well, they really are. No matter what kind of book I wrote, after 30 years, I found out I was always writing about the same people. Whether it was the Rockefeller Corporation, Standard Oil, by the Federal Reserve Bank.
Right.
Or anything else, it was always the same cast of characters.
Well, reading your book, I mean, I wrote a lot of stuff in the margins. Most of it wows, the word wow. But you had one that really floored me, because I covered the assassination of JFK a lot on my show, and I intend to keep covering it because I know we were lied to. But you actually put down that, I believe it was John Foster Dulles, that was at the meeting of the Federal Reserve when they agreed to bankroll Hitler.
Oh, yeah.
Do you want to talk a little bit on that?
And his brother both were the lawyers for Sullivan Cromwell, which represented the biggest Wall Street banks. And they went to Hitler's office in Germany in 1933 and guaranteed him the money for the Third Reich.
Right. Well, I mean, when you look at that and then you go down and you think about Alan Dulles and his part in the JFK assassination, you really get sick to your stomach as an American, realizing that we've been pretty much jerked around by the same bank, you know, group of thieves forever.
J. Henry Schroeder of Cologne, Germany, is the bank which bankrolled Hitler. And so when Alan Dulles became head of the Central Intelligence Agency, he immediately employed Schroeder as the bank for the entire CIA, and they made him a director of Henry Schroeder Company.
Right, and the Schroeder Company obviously wasn't an American company.
Oh, no, it was not American. It was London and Germany.
Right. Now, where does the London Bank play into all of this? Do we really pay part of our income tax to England?
The Bank of England really runs the American economy, because I point out in my book on the Federal Reserve that there are 17 merchant banks in London, and they became the principal bankrollers of the entire Federal Reserve system in the United States.
Right. And so are we paying them back debt on that money, or how does that work?
Oh, that is all debt money. We're paying them for everything. They set our interest rate. You know, the interest rate in the United States is set on the London Exchange.
Oh, you mean Alan Greenspan doesn't set the interest rate?
Well, Alan Greenspan, I've told people before, Alan Greenspan has no more authority in running the Federal Reserve System than I have. He just takes orders.
Uh-huh. So where do you think he takes orders from? The City of London?
Partner of J.P. Morgan before he became governor of the Federal Reserve System. So I would think that Morgan and Rothschild and Kuhn-Loeb pull his chain all the time.
Right, because, you know, a lot of times when I read books on the Federal Reserve, writers tend to be very obscure. They don't really tell you who's behind it all. Your book leaves nothing out.
No college in this country will tell you anything about the Federal Reserve System. They have courses on economics, but when they mention the Federal Reserve System, it's with an attitude of such raw reverence and awe.
Uh-huh.
It won't tell you anything.
Right. So, you know, there was rumor that at the time of JFK's assassination, that he wanted to take the money back to the Treasury Department, and that played in somehow to his assassination. Do you agree with that?
Oh, I agree with that entirely. That's only a small part of the story. You see, like every president, JFK began to think about his legacy, what he was going to leave behind as president. And he asked some of his advisors, and one of them told him, well, if you could get the Federal Reserve System off the backs of the American people, they would put a statue up to you in every town in the United States.
Right.
So, well, JFK knew something about it because, you see, his father, old Joe Kennedy, had started as the state bank examiner for the state of Massachusetts. So he now had the banks worked from the inside, and he knew all about it. And he said, I think you're right. I think that's the way to go. And it wasn't long after that that it was assassinated.
Right, because I know that Lincoln wanted to go back to, was it silver certificates?
All right. Lincoln went back to the greenbacks.
Okay, and...
And JFK did the same thing.
Uh-huh.
Under the Constitution, the Treasury Department has authority to print non-interest-bearing currency. See, all of our interest, all of our currency is issued against paper bonds, which draw interest.
Right.
So you pay at least 10% interest on every dollar that you have in your pocket.
Right, which is crazy. We pay them to print the money, and then we pay them interest on top of the money, and the money really has no value anyway.
No, it's absolutely worthless. It's counterfeit money.
Right. Now, today's news came out and said that the U.S. trade deficit is at an all-time high. It's at $61.4 billion. Do you see the Federal Reserve as responsible for that?
Oh, entirely, because the Federal Reserve, when it was incorporated in 1913, its stated purpose was to stabilize the dollar. Well, the dollar, which was worth $1 in 1914 when it began operation, is now worth 2 cents.
Right. Well, our dollar's not worth much around the world either. It's more like 60 cents now.
Oh, yes.
In fake money. You know, it's like monopoly money.
Oh, yeah, it certainly is. It's all fiat money.
All right, I have a question for you from one of my listeners, and it's a common question that they ask of my guests. He says, so once again, the question arises, if this thing has been going on for so long, what hope do we have to change it? What can we do?
Well, in my lectures all around the country, I used to talk about the Federal Reserve System, and then when I had a question and answer period, the first question from the audience was always a panicked question. Well, if we get rid of the Federal Reserve, what do we replace it with? And I always answer them, well, what would you replace the mafia with if you got rid of it?
That's a good one. What would you replace the mafia with?
It is like the mafia.
Well, I mean, but what would be the difference if the U.S. Treasury just took over the money at this point, even the same exact money?
Well, the Federal Reserve, I mean, the Department of Treasury did not take over anything. When they passed the Federal Reserve Act of 1913, the Federal Reserve Act specifically stated that the Department of Treasury would no longer be the fiscal agent of the United States government, and that the Federal Reserve System would be the only fiscal agent of the United States government.
Uh-huh.
And yet the IRS will send you a tax bill, and they say Department of the Treasury on it. When they've been relieved of as fiscal agent of the United States, they have no authority to collect taxes whatsoever.
Well, you know, there are a lot of people that make that case and say, you know, you should drop off the tax rolls and not pay taxes. What do you think about that?
Well, it's supposed to be 25 million people doing that, and the government does absolutely nothing about it because there's nothing they can do. They have no authority to collect the money anyway, and they're collecting it for a privately owned bank. In other words, when the IRS collects income tax from you as a citizen,
right,
they are collecting a debt owed to a private bank. And it's like any other bank, Chase Bank or National City Bank, that this is the bank claims you owe them money, and so they act as a private collection agency to collect that money.
Well, if you think about it, and you know, so many Americans actually fear the IRS.
Well, of course they fear them because they're operating illegitimately, and when an organization is operating illegitimately, they have to keep you fearful all the time.
Right, because a lot of people actually believe that that money goes to the government.
Well, they do. They think that it pays for operating the cost of the government. And it only pays the interest on the Federal Reserve created money.
Right. Now, I assume the money that does go to the governor, your state and sales tax, that kind of thing, right?
The states, small taxes, all kinds of taxes on various imports, exports, and so forth.
Right. So when they take an American who hasn't paid his income tax and they fine him or they put him in jail, obviously that's an illegal act.
Oh, totally illegal. He's committed no crime. They claim he owes money to a private bank, and they're acting as a collection agency for a private bank.
Right.
With no constitutional authority for that whatsoever.
Right. But meanwhile, you know, they get away with it. I mean, you know, you have to think in terms of, well, how do you fight that? I mean, you get an attorney to say that this is an illegal tax on a person?
Well, you can hire an attorney, but you see, the IRS agents have guns.
Yeah, that's true, and I've seen them ruin a lot of people, that's for sure.
Oh, yes. A lot of people have died of nervous breakdowns and suicides because of IRS agents.
Oh, yeah, for sure. It's another fear tactic. Eustace, you talk about the Rothschilds, and you talk in your book about, let me get it right, the Zionist movement to create the State of Israel. And I think whenever you take on the Rothschilds or the Zionists, you immediately get called an anti-Semite, which...
You're called an anti-Semite. When William Jennings Bryan was Woodrow Wilson's Secretary of State, he criticized the activities of the Rothschilds in setting up the First World War. And so they immediately called him anti-Semitic. And he replied in a published address that he only criticized the Rothschilds because of their banking activities. And he never criticized them as Jewish people whatsoever. He never criticized their religion. But they always bring up that anti-Semitic. You know, they claim that I'm the most virulent anti-Semite in the United States, and they call me a rabid anti-Semite.
Well, I have to tell you that I have heard that.
Heard it because you hear it everywhere.
Right.
And you hear it after this talk show, probably.
Well, do you consider yourself an anti-Semite?
Certainly not.
Okay, because, I mean, I totally understand the difference between Zionism and Judaism. It's like two different worlds.
Well, yes, Zionism is actually Reform Judaism. The Rothschilds created Reform Judaism in 1828 because, you see, the Orthodox Jewish people fervently believed that not only was Christ not their Messiah, but their Messiah had not arrived on earth, which he still hasn't, apparently.
Right.
According to Orthodox Judaism, there can be no kingdom of the Jews, or country of the Jews, anywhere in the world until the Messiah comes. So your Orthodox Jews consider the State of Israel entirely illegitimate.
Oh, yeah, that I've covered with other guests on the show, including the rabbi.
Yeah, well, any rabbi would tell you that.
Right. Now, wasn't it the Rothschilds that were involved in the Balfour Declaration?
Oh, yes, Lord Lionel Rothschild got the Balfour Declaration signed by Secretary Balfour in the English cabinet, creating a national home for the Jews. And they created the national home for the Jews at the ancient crossroads of the world, which was in Palestine. And this meant a great deal to them to get that territory because it meant that they would symbolically rule the world.
Right. Right. One of my listeners is saying, I think what you're saying, Eustace, is very important for Americans to know. And I totally agree. I want to take a break here, Eustace, and tell my listeners. I have this book available through my book list on my website. It's simple. It's called The Secrets of the Federal Reserve. It's the number one book you must read and pass around. Buy 12 of them and give them out to everybody you know. You're not going to find a better book on not just the Federal Reserve, but how it's ruined our country since the get-go. And that brings me, Eustace, to the Great Depression. I mean, I have to tell you, I got such an education reading your book that there were actually things with all the books I've read that have shocked me reading this.
Oh, this was nothing but money manipulation. They were juggling the markets of the world to help England stay on the gold standard. That was the whole idea. Probably at the crash of 29.
Right.
Now that's according to official government documents. There were congressional hearings which were held into the cause of the 1929 crash, and they concluded it was because we were trying to help England.
Yeah, they wanted to help England, and that was another thing that I didn't realize is how much gold the United States returned to Europe while no one here was looking because we were too busy with the war.
Oh, yeah. Not only did we return the gold, but they murdered the Tsar of Russia, who was the richest man in the world. And after they murdered him and his family, they took all of his gold out of Moscow. And that gold went directly to the Bank of England and to Kuhnlobe in New York City.
Right. Now, you know, a lot of people in America are under the impression, Eustace, that every one of our dollars is backed by gold.
Oh, yes. They really think that because it's actually backed supposedly by the faith and credit of the United States, whatever that is.
Right. Well, it doesn't look like our credit's doing too well now.
No, not much faith either.
Right. Right. But you know what? I saw a lot of names in your books like Lord Montague, Norman, so many other people that now I realize were total enemies of the state. And having grown up in New York, in Brooklyn, New York, I remember so many of the streets in the most expensive neighborhoods named for all these criminals.
Certainly.
And you know what? It really hurts me now realizing that, you know, all these people actually had streets and avenues named after them.
Well, they really did. And they also had hospitals and colleges named after them.
Right.
They were the biggest contributors to these various enterprises.
Exactly. So let's get back, and we'll go back in time, because I did interview Ed Griffin on his book, Creature from Jekyll Island. And a lot of people don't even know what Jekyll Island was or the Jekyll Island Hunt Club. Would you like to talk a little to that?
Yes, I take that up in my book, that at the time the Federal Reserve Act was secretly drafted as a criminal conspiracy at Jekyll Island, Georgia in 1910. This was at Thanksgiving week of 1910 when the act was actually put together by Paul Warburg.
Right.
And, this was their private millionaire's resort there. They bought the whole island, and only their friends lived there. And the members of the Jekyll Island Club in 1910 comprised one-sixth of the wealth of the entire world.
Even then. And don't these people pretty much own most of the wealth in the world today, too?
Yes, if they had one-sixth of the world's wealth in 1910, I would say they have about 90% of it at the present time.
Right, right. So, you know, I've had other guests on the show, one that reveres you. He writes very endearing about you in his book, Stephen Zarlingo, The Lost Science of Money. He thinks that we should have a fourth branch of government installed to take the money back, to actually have the government.
There's no Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, that Congress should have total control over weights and measures and the money. And that was violated in 1913 by the passage of the Federal Reserve Act, in which Congress unconstitutionally delegated those powers to a private bank, which has been ever since.
Right. So what do you think our chances are of taking it back without, you know, all of us getting assassinated?
Well, the very last section of the Federal Reserve Act of 1913, Section 34, states, and this was passed as a stop to the congressman, that Congress reserves the right to alter or repeal this act at any time. And that's been on the books since 1913. And, of course, no congressman has ever acted to alter or repeal it. But it's on the books. They can do it.
Well, reading through your book, there were a lot of brave politicians that tried to intercede and stop this.
Oh, I knew quite a few of them, right? Patman was a good friend of mine. And now, I didn't know Lewis McFadden. He was murdered before I could make his acquaintance.
Right. I mean, they didn't make out too well. And even every time that they got close to getting it prosecuted, the whole thing was just dropped.
Oh, it was dropped because they could not get another congressman to vote with them on any thing affecting the Federal Reserve System.
Right. So why do you think that is? Do you think Congress is also bought and paid for by these same people?
Well, it takes an enormous amount of money to run for Congress, and all that money is supplied by the Federal Reserve bankers.
Right. So they own. In other words, if the criminals own the enterprise can't be clean.
Well, the criminals own the enterprise because they print their own money. You know, the Federal Reserve is a classic central bank which has the right of issue. Now, the right of issue simply means the right to print money. And if you've got that right, you don't really need anything else.
Right, exactly.
You can print all the money you want, and there's absolutely no restriction on how much money the Federal Reserve can print.
Right, right. Well, you know, I'd like to, in honor of Ezra Pound, read from the introduction of your book, just the first paragraph, where it's a quote that Ezra Pound made while he was in St. Elizabeth's Hospital. He said, "Here are the simple facts of the great betrayal. Wilson and House knew that they were doing something momentous. One cannot fathom men's motives, and this pair probably believed in what they were up to. What they did not believe in was representative government. They believed in government by an uncontrolled oligarchy whose acts would only become apparent after an interval so long that the electorate would be forever incapable of doing anything efficient to remedy depredations." And, you know, you read that and you can really get why they threw this guy away and locked the door behind him.
Oh, they certainly did. They intended it was boasted of in Washington in 1950 that Ezra Pound would die in St. Elizabeth Hospital. He would never be released. And that was reported back to me, and I thought his chances were pretty grim myself.
Uh-huh. Now, Thomas Jefferson, you know, who I believe was probably, you know, no one was perfect, obviously, that we've ever had in this country, but what did Jefferson think about a central bank or an incorporated bank?
Well, he fought against it very vocally. You see, when George Washington became president of the United States, the first thing he did was to charter a central bank, the first bank of the United States, which was the Rothschild Bank out of London.
Uh-huh.
And that was a central bank, and so with the right of issue. And so Jefferson, even though he's a member of Washington's cabinet, he campaigned against it. And it was passed over his objections. Washington signed the First Bank of the United States charter.
Uh-huh.
When Jefferson became president, he allowed the charter to lapse. He refused to renew it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why we had the War of 1812. As soon as he refused to renew the charter of the First Bank of the United States, England declared war on us again. That was the War of 1812. Now, you won't find that in any history book. They have a lot of esoteric reasons why England attacked us in 1812, but the sole reason was the fact that Jefferson, as president, refused to renew the charter of the Bank of the United States.
Right. So you're saying from the beginning, from the inception, George Washington actually put in a bank that was a Rothschild bank in our country.
Well, George Washington didn't know anything about banks. He was a farmer. But you see, Jefferson was a Virginia farmer also, but he had the most classic understanding of banking of any person I've ever read in my life.
Uh-huh.
And how he got this in the hills of Virginia, I have no idea.
Huh. Well, maybe he was just way ahead of his time.
Well, he was a very wealthy man. You know, his father left him 25,000 acres of the most valuable land in the state of Virginia.
Uh-huh.
And he died bankrupt.
Right, well.
Everything was sold, his house and everything was sold at auction to the public. And most of his furniture disappeared, too. It's very hard to find original Monticello furniture because it was all sold at auction. People bought it from all over, and they were very glad to get it.
Right. Well, let's jump over to another, what I would assume is a hero, Congressman Charles Augustus Lindbergh, Sr.
Oh, I know his son, Charles Lindbergh, and he reveres me because I revere his grandfather.
Oh, is this his grandfather?
Uh-huh.
Now, he spoke out against the Federal Reserve, and one of the quotes that you have in your book is, "Our financial system is a false one and a huge burden on the people. This act establishes the most gigantic trust on earth."
Well, it did, and it still does.
Right. Now, is this the same Lindbergh of the Lindbergh kidnapping?
No, the Lindbergh of the Lindbergh kidnapping. See, the original Congressman Charles Augustus Lindbergh Sr. was a very wealthy Minnesota lawyer, and he represented a lot of big companies. He represented Weyerhaeuser Lumber, and he represented some of the big other companies. But he simply could not go with the banking system, and he fought it from the very beginning.
Right. Right. Okay, because I wanted to get that straight, because I was thinking, wow, if it's the same one, no wonder they kidnapped his baby.
No, no.
Okay.
His son was the aviator. He was Charles Augustus Lindbergh, Jr., and there was Charles III, who was the kidnapped boy, who is still alive and whom I know well. He was never kidnapped at all. The whole kidnapping was faked and for various reasons.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And he never died. They found a body out in the woods, which they claimed was his body. But the man is still quite healthy and alive today. I talk to him occasionally.
Uh-huh.
He's in San Jose, California.
Uh-huh. Okay, you mention in your book an attorney from Cleveland, Ohio, Alfred Crozier.
Oh, yes. Crozier's book was really a very land-breaking book.
Right. Now, he pointed out that when our government had to issue money based on privately owned securities, we were no longer a free nation.
That's right.
So is it safe to say that when the Federal Reserve really locked in 1913, that we really lost our democracy?
Oh, Congress no longer existed. Congress became an agency of the Federal Reserve System. That's all they've done ever since.
Right. So if they set the price of gold, you know, if the Federal Reserve sets the price of gold, the value of a dollar, Do they also set the prices on everything else, like this, the recent oil crisis in America?
Well, a lady asked me yesterday, who sets the price of oil? Because, of course, the price keeps going up every day. And I said, the oil companies set the price of oil. They are principally owned by the Rothschilds.
The oil companies are owned by the Rothschilds.
Well, John D. Rockefeller is entirely bankrolled by Coulomb Company out of New York City and Cleveland, Ohio. And he himself was a $10 a week clerk. So when you're earning $10 a week, it's a little difficult to set up the greatest monopoly on earth.
Exactly. Well, you have quite a few samples of people that performed all kinds of miracles. Now, wasn't Paul Warburg's brother a spy or an intel for Germany at the time he was becoming the American hero?
He was Kaiser Wilhelm's private banker in Germany at the time that his brother Paul was the head of the Federal Reserve System in Washington, D.C. And these countries were locked in a war to the death. So you wonder how impartial either one of them was in this World War I.
Right.
And there was a naval intelligence reported to Congress that Paul Warburg's brother Max was the head of German intelligence during World War I.
Right.
They were concerned about this, naturally, being in the intelligence business themselves. And so they wanted to remove Paul Warburg, but they didn't get very far with that.
No, obviously he was too powerful. And, you know, you think about it, I've covered with a lot of other guests, you know, how many Nazis we snuck or, you know, visibly just took into this country after World War II.
Oh, well, they did indeed.
And a lot with the help of the Catholic Church.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so here everybody's revering the Catholic Church because the Pope died. And they don't realize that it was the church that helped sneak all these Nazis into our country. So, you know, I wonder if the Nazis are still ruling America.
Oh, yes. The Catholic organizations brought them all in.
Right.
And that's why our entire space program was run by former Nazis down in Huntsville, Alabama.
Right. So I still wonder when they say they want to be masters of space, if it's still, you know, the Nazi philosophy behind it.
Oh, yeah. That's the Nazi organization all the way.
Right.
A goal that had been set by Hitler. Well, we're still carrying out Hitler's orders, you know. When President Clinton ordered Yugoslavia to be bombed, that brought back a Hitler program, which he was ready to bomb Yugoslavia into submission during World War II.
Right.
And then he got bogged down in Russia, and he wasn't able to do it. So they had to wait until President Clinton came along to carry out the Hitler objective of bombing Yugoslavia.
Right. Do you think that our government is intent on destroying what little is left of our country?
Oh, it looks that way because they're well on their way to it.
Because I know that, you know, you are one of our senior citizens, so I have to defer to you that you've lived longer than I have and seen a lot more.
Oh, I've served through it entirely. I was in the U.S. Air Force throughout World War II, and I often tell people that's the last war that we won.
Right. Right. One of my listeners has a question, Eustace. He said he's read some articles about the Federal Reserve Act and the passage of it, which caused the United States to become bankrupt so that Congress presides over the largest bankrupt entity ever. He wants to know if that's correct.
Well, we essentially operate under laws of bankruptcy today. That's absolutely true because the country was officially declared bankrupt in 1933. And I've traveled around with people at various meetings who have all the details on that, and it's an official doctrine that we went bankrupt in 1933.
And we never came out of it.
The Depression, which has been caused by our helping the Federal Reserve, helping England during the crash of 1929.
Right. They were more interested in sending the gold back to England than preserving the United States' economy. You know, you have so much in this book that I can just tell people you must read it because it's one of those books where I think I underlined almost every single thing in the book.
Well, now, so often when people bring up a book for me to autograph and I open it, every word is underlined in yellow. It looks terrible.
Well, you can't help it, though, because you want to recall it all. You know, you talk about, obviously, Congressman Lindbergh was a real hero.
He was one of the great heroes of America. He tried to preserve this country.
Right. And then when he talked about the Federal Reserve, he said, "This act establishes the most gigantic trust on earth, When the president signs this bill, the invisible government by the monetary power will be legalized.
Oh, yes. Everything is legal that they do.
Right. And he said it was the worst legislative crime of the ages perpetrated by that banking bill. So we hear talk about a secret government, and people say that, oh, you're a conspiracy freak. But obviously, even Lindbergh knew that the Federal Reserve was creating an invisible government.
Oh, they really did. Now, I've had articles about me in major newspapers. The Dallas Morning News had a front page story about me in which young female journalist described me as a conspiratologist.
Right.
And I replied to them that I have never had to invent a conspiracy in my life. There's so many now that I can keep up with them all.
Right. To me, everything coming out of our government is a conspiracy unless they prove differently.
Well, I have called the Federal Reserve System a criminal syndicate for many years, and it's stated right there in plain English in my book that because it was a secret conspiratorial meeting at Jekyll Island in 1910, and they even dismissed all the servants at this meeting, and of course these are very wealthy people, they had to have a lot of servants around,
right.
They imported servants from the mainland of Georgia to wait on them, and they agreed not to mention each other's last names all the time they were there at this meeting.
Right.
Oh, the first name club. It was Paul and Henry and so forth. No last names were ever used.
Right. I mean, you know, if they were doing anything above board, why would they need to go through such extremes? That's for sure.
Well, I've never heard of any private club in the United States where the members were afraid to mention their last names.
Right, right. So, Eustace, let me ask you this. If the Federal Reserve Act pretty much destroyed our democracy and it put us continuously in the hands of the same evildoers, you know, the Rothschild, Rockefellers, et cetera, has our vote ever meant a damn thing in this country?
How come what?
Has our vote ever meant a damn thing in this country?
It means absolutely nothing because every candidate is vetted by the Federal Reserve bankers, whether Democrat or Republican, the party labels mean absolutely nothing anymore.
Right, so when people are complaining, you know, this election was stolen, this one was stolen, they've all pretty much been stolen since the beginning.
In fact, I say it's like you're going before a jury and all the jurors are already sworn to vote against you.
Right, exactly. Well, we saw what happened in 2000 with the Supreme Court, so that should have been a big wake-up call for America, but it obviously didn't work.
Well, people asked me in the election of 2000, who is going to win? And I said, well, the CIA will win. You can't beat the CIA.
Right.
Bush's father was head of the CIA.
Well, yeah, and I mean, you know, I saw a story this morning that, you know, Clinton finally found his surrogate family in the Bush family.
Oh, yeah.
So I said, how much more obvious can they possibly be?
Well, they really are. They're very flagrant about the whole thing. And, you know, in the last election, Bush ran against John Kerry, and they were both members of the Skull and Bones, which is one of those secretive fraternities in the United States.
Right, exactly. That's what I said. You know, why you're going to vote for one world order one way or one world order the other?
Yeah, when people asked me how I was going to vote in 2004, I said I'm going to vote for Skull and Bones.
You're going to vote for the 2004, right? It was the truth of it, but people didn't want to hear it.
I voted for Skull and Bones.
Right. So what do you think about this latest bankruptcy bill that they've put out there, which obviously favors the credit card companies? Are the credit card companies owned by the same people?
Oh, they certainly are. They're all right out of the banks. And, well, I don't know what any bankruptcy legislation means for a country that's already bankrupt anyway.
Right, right. Well, now it looks like they really want to take the little guy out at the knees, which seems to be their, you know, their style.
Bankruptcy. You know, when you're bankrupt, you're a complete slave to everybody.
Right.
They reduced the population of the United States to medieval serfs.
Uh-huh. Crazy.
You know, the word attorney comes from a tourneur in French, which means a person who will represent the transfer of a serf from one medieval state to another.
Uh-huh.
That's all an attorney means.
Right, so we're all like indentured slaves anyway.
Well, indentured slaves, yes, and serfs.
serfs. And, you know, very few people use that word. When I use it, my son always laughs at me.
That's a little strange. But indentured servants, a lot of Americans came over to the United to this country originally as settlers, as indentured servants, because they didn't have the money for the passage.
Right.
So bankers would lend them their passage money, and they had to work for 5 or 10 years after they landed in America to pay that money back.
Right. Now, you also talk about in your book, which is, you know, I've covered on my show too, but I'd like you to address it a little. With the control of the money came the control of the news media. Today, you know, we have a news media that is might as well call themselves Pentagon Media.
Oh, it is Pentagon Media. And, you know, when I was in Washington in the 1940s, I spent a lot of time at the National Press Club. The founder, George Simpson, was a very good friend. And so I knew everybody around there. And they had a little table in the anteroom of the entrance to the press club, and there were stacks of just ordinary black and white mimeograph press releases from the various government agencies, and the reporters, instead of going to the agencies, would simply pick up their press releases at that National Press Club and print them in the newspapers all over the world as news.
Right. Well, that seems to be the same today.
Well, I saw that firsthand.
Wow. Well, I'm sure you've seen a lot more things firsthand than I did. Now, you have a sentence in your book that I think would be appropriate to talk about now because we're kind of close on time. And it's on page 67. The astounding idea that the Federal Reserve System of the United States is actually operated from London will probably be rejected at first hearing by most Americans.
Well, actually, we never got free of England. The Revolutionary War, we won some temporary victories, but you see, George Washington immediately signed the charter of the First Bank of the United States, which was a Bank of England organization, so we're right back in the hands of England at the end of the war, and we have been there ever since.
Right, right, exactly. And, you know, again, you know, it is a hard pill for most Americans to follow because we've been lied to. You know, I remember when I was in school, Eustace, being taught that our dollar was backed by gold and, you know, all these wonderful things about, you know, our money in this country, which, of course, was all lies. But it is a very personal thing when you start to expose this to Americans, because a lot of Americans really just don't want to know.
Oh, I've been reviled and attacked, usually as a rabid anti-Semite, whenever I mention the Federal Reserve System. In fact, Rush Limbaugh, the great talk show host, he will not allow anyone to call into his show and talk about the Bilderbergers, the Council on Foreign Relations, or the Federal Reserve System. And if you're a tax protester, you cannot call in on Rush Limbaugh's show. And he's considered the great conservative.
Well, really, I get. But you know what? A lot of my guests tell me that they have a very hard time getting on anybody's show.
Oh, yes, indeed.
So, you know, that's yet another reason why I do what I do. Now, you have some excellent charts in your book, connecting everybody to everything. And when I saw even JCPenney
in the book, and I was advised to put those in by a guy who was helping me revise the book in 1982, Edward Durrell, who's now deceased. He suggested I put in charts because he was a businessman. And businessmen like charts, and so I put the charts together, and they worked out fine.
Right, they're beautiful. And you know, when you really look and see what's connected to it, and I have to tell you, I was surprised at seeing JCPenney and Avon on one of those charts.
Oh, they're all in there.
You say, wow, these people have their fingers everywhere.
Well, the John Birch Society is supposed to be the great anti-communist society by Robert Welch. And I found out that Nelson Rockefeller had a private meeting with Robert Welch, and the Rockefellers agreed to buy the Welch Candy Company, which he owned at that time. So that he would have full time to devote to the John Birch Society.
Hmm.
It still is part of the Rockefeller Holdings.
Right. Well, you know, one of the more interesting stories, little piece of Americana you have in there, is about Franklin Roosevelt being backed by wealthy international homosexuals.
Oh, there was a very strong homosexual connection all the way through, because J.P. Morgan's daughter, he was one of the architects of the Federal Reserve System, his daughter Anne was a very prominent lesbian, and she never married, of course. And So she started a homosexual community among the millionaires in New York City, which became Sup Place, which is the most exclusive place to live in New York City.
Right, I never knew the story of Sutton Place, and I mean, I lived there. Do you know what I mean? There's so much interesting stuff in this book that people should read it 10 times over.
Well, it's a fascinating book. When I started the book, I was fascinated by the subject, and I've been fascinated for 50 years. And many people who get this book tell me, they call me up and complain that Eustace, I had to sit up all night reading your book because I couldn't put it down.
Well, you can't put it down. And like I said, I usually, because I get so many books submitted to me, I never spend the time on a book that I did on yours, but I was like, oh, I can't afford to miss one word in this book. Because you know what? I thought, and I believed all the hype that people said about Franklin Roosevelt being such a great president. But reading your book, I mean, it just made me realize that we've never had a decent president in this country.
Oh, well, Ezra Pound said that the last good president we had was Calvin Coolidge.
Uh-huh.
And Calvin Coolidge was a very good American, and he, apparently I never found he had any connection with the bankers. He's a distant cousin of mine. The Coolidges came down through the Alden family, and my ancestor, John Mullins, his daughter Priscilla, married John Alden.
Oh.
So most of the old New England families are related to the Alden family.
Who knew? I remember learning the poems about John Alden when I was in school.
Oh, yes, indeed. It's part of the folklore of New England.
Right. Wow. It gets pretty deep. Eustace, one thing that I'd like to say before we conclude the show is it's been a pleasure talking to you, and I would love to have you come back on the show and talk some more.
Well, if the Federal Reserve doesn't go away, I'm willing to come on another time.
Oh, well, great, great, because I'll definitely want to have you back on. I'd like to end with a quote from Congressman Patman, because I think it's a very easy explanation of what the Federal Reserve is. And it's on page 165 in your book. It says, as Congressman Patman puts it, the dollar represents a $1 debt to the Federal Reserve system. The Federal Reserve banks create money out of thin air to buy government bonds from the United States Treasury, lending money into circulation at interest, by bookkeeping entries of checkbook credit to the United States Treasury. The Treasury writes up an interest-bearing bond for $1 billion. The Federal Reserve gives the Treasury a $1 billion credit for the bond and has created out of nothing a $1 billion debt which the American people are obligated to pay with interest. And I think that's the easiest way to explain our fiat money, which is basically air money.
Air money. Well, in fact, many officials of the Federal Reserve System have testified before Congress that they ask, where do you get the money for this? And they say, we create the money out of nothing.
Exactly. You know, and it's funny, Eustace, this week I saw a news story where three teenagers in America were arrested for counterfeiting money that they were using in their school lunchroom. And I said, why should they be arrested when the Federal Reserve's been counterfeiting money for years?
Well, they create money out of nothing, and really, if it's illegal, it should be illegal for everybody.
I totally agree. Eustace, I want to thank you so much for joining me this morning. It was absolutely fabulous.
Well, I've enjoyed your show.
Oh, well, good, and we'll definitely do this again.
All right, fine.
Thanks so much.
Very good.
Take care now.
All right.
That was Eustace Mullins, the author of The Secrets of the Federal Reserve. I guarantee you, no matter how many books you've read about it, you're going to learn a lot more in this, and you're going to learn a lot of history, like some of the things we talked about today. And just crazy stuff, I have to tell you. Tomorrow, Carl Schwartz, one-way ticket to Crawford, Texas. We'll pick up where we left
off. Maria with an E, the mouth that roars, the Maria Heller Show. Number one show on the net for 5 years in a row. Though the mainstream press may be frightened, scared, and cowed, she's not afraid to tell the truth and to tell it loud. So watch out, all you Enrons, Halliburtons, Worldcoms, and Worldcons. She's gonna shine, shine, shine the light of truth on you. She's the weapon of mass instruction.
M-E-R-I-A.net. M-E-R-I-A.